disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and find our research interesting, please consider supporting us. Head over to www.deadsoulspodcast.com and see how you can donate to our research and investigations and find other ways to support us. We really appreciate you stopping by. You can also find us over on Instagram if that's more your thing. Just search Dead Souls Podcast and we'll come up. As always, thank you for joining us. It was the illustrious days of the early 1990s, the post-Cold War decade as it became to be known. Before George W. Bush, Tony Blair and Al-Qaeda came along and fucked things up, the Soviet Union had collapsed, the World Wide Web had launched. Nirvana remained the best band in the entire universe, even though its lead singer and guitarist Kurt Cobain had allegedly killed himself. The McDonald's restaurant chain launched the supersized meal option, and The Simpsons was the biggest television show on earth. Times were good. Life was simple. Then, on September the 16th, 1994, in the unexpected eastern Zimbabwe town of Rua, 62 students at the Ariel School, a private, independent Christian trust school, were witness to an extraordinary event. The event remains to this day as one of historical significance, particularly for those who research such phenomenon. The memories stayed with those who witnessed it, affecting them in many different ways, both positive and negative. The students involved in the event were all aged between 6 and 12 years old at the time. Let's talk a little bit more. This is one peculiar day in September. Rua is a small agricultural town located about 14 miles or 22 kilometers southeast of the capital of Zimbabwe, Harare. At the time that the incident occurred, Rua was not even a town, but simply a small place name amounting to nothing more than a crossroads in an agricultural region. The Ariel School was an expensive private school. The pupils were mostly from wealthy white families in Harare or neighboring South Africa. None of the pupils were local to the area. Over the days just prior to the incident at the Ariel School, there had been several UFO sightings throughout southern Africa. The sightings were significant enough and witnessed to the extent that they made the local and national news in Zimbabwe and South Africa at the time. There had been a number of reports of a bright fireball passing through the sky in the darkness of the night. Witnesses answered ZBC Radio's request to call in to their evening news show and describe what they had seen. The reports were consistent and fairly astonishing. Some witnesses refused to speculate on the object that they saw being unidentified or a craft, and instead interpreted the fireball as a comet or a meteor. The sightings resulted in a reasonably large wave of UAP mania in the area at the time. Locals had heard stories of UFOs from Western nations, but had never experienced or noted any such thing so close to home before. It was exciting. There was a buzz. Later, renowned American skeptic and science writer Brian Dunning would claim that the fireball had simply been the re-entry of the ex-Soviet Zenit 2 rocket, making its return from the Cosmos 2290 satellite launch. The rocket booster, Dunning claims, broke up into burning streaks as it moved silently across the night sky, providing an impressive show of light to millions of citizens across Africa. So, as usual, here on Dead Souls, I wanted to give credence and a balanced observation of all the data and information. So I did some further digging, both into Ukrainian government records and also declassified NASA intelligence records. For your information, NASA doesn't actually conduct espionage or intelligence reconnaissance. However, As the information relates to space, it is logged on the NSS DCA catalog at NASA, and though likely collected by another agency. Further, the reason this information was corroborated with Ukrainian source documents was that in 1994, the Soviet Union had recently broken apart, and the Zenit rockets fell under Ukrainian use briefly at the time. Nothing is straightforward, right? Anyway, what I found was that due to significant funding issues post-Soviet era, the Ukraine only launched one Zenit 2 rocket. It was carrying the Cosmos 2290 satellite, as Dunning had stated, and it was launched from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. So yes, again, as Dunning had stated, this rocket had broken apart and its pieces would have been visible in the skies over some parts of Africa. The issue, however, which causes Dunning's dismissal of the UFO events, was that the Zenit 2 rocket was launched on the 26th of September 1994, some 10 to 14 days after the UFO sightings and events. In addition, I came across the research of Cynthia Hind, a South African journalist and researcher into UAP phenomenon. She had recorded additional unknown aircraft sightings at these times, and included a daylight sighting by a young boy and his mother, and also a report from a truck driver who, along with two other motorists, had observed a craft which had landed by the side of a road and from which alleged extraterrestrial beings had emerged and walked around. These accounts also seem to play against Brian Dunning's dismissal of events. 2 days after these erratic events, on September the 16th, the strange and peculiar incidents in Zimbabwe seemed to step up a notch on the scale of astonishing experiences. At around 10 a.m, pupils at the aerial school were outside on their mid-morning break. The adult faculty at the school were inside having a staff meeting at the time. The following incident would last for a total of around 15 minutes. As previously mentioned, there were 62 pupils within the playground area of the school. Now bear in mind that this was rural Zimbabwe in Africa, so the playground was a dirt field with short grass and scrub. The children spoke how they saw one or more silver craft slowly descend from the sky and land on the field at the rear of the school, beyond the property limits. The craft sat stationary for a while. Some children ran away, but others crept closer, standing at a log pile around 14 to 20 feet away from the object. The children said the craft gave off a strange sound, kind of like a faint flute sound as it touched down, high-pitched and mesmerizing. None of the children could explain how, but moments, in fact just seconds later, the children consistently all stated that they saw two men-like creatures, but not men. One was standing motionless, staring at the children, next to the craft. Another seemed to be running around the craft very quickly. The motionless stranger appeared to be wearing a full bodysuit. Children said it looked like a black wetsuit or a scuba diving outfit. A full bodysuit with no obvious buttons or zips, but with his head exposed. Exposed in that the entity was not wearing a helmet. It stared at them with a round or oval-shaped head with large black elongated oval eyes, no hair, and a very small nose and tiny mouth, just a slit, in fact, above its chin. The facial features of the being sat lower on its head than ours did, one of the children later said, meaning its forehead, vertex, and calvaria were larger and more domed than the human head. The eyes, the children said, eyes were lifeless and looked evil. Its eyes were absent of empathy or emotion, like a doll's eyes or shark's eyes, a black abyss of nothingness. The entity did not appear to have any ears, at least none that were visible on its head. It just stared directly at us, the children said. The children all agreed that the entity was between 3 to 4 feet in height. Some of the children began to cry and walk away, back toward the school, not run, just slowly walked away in tears, overwhelmed with emotion. Time also appeared to have slowed down. The children reported that their surroundings started to feel like it was in slow motion, but it wasn't. they felt overcome with a strange relaxed but tingling feeling. The entity that was running around the craft also climbed on top of the craft and continued to move quickly and erratically on and around the silver object. One or more of the creatures then approached the children, and in what seemed like, all the children would later agree, would be an attempt to telepathically communicate with the children. They were all overcome with a feeling of fear, but not fear for their lives, but with an urgent worry and concern for the planet and the environment. The images in the children's minds and the feelings that they had overcome them frightened many of the children, and they got upset and anxious. The entity communicated future concerns and warnings to the children about how mankind were harming the planet with its wars and harvesting of all its natural resources. When the children returned to class, they all immediately told the teachers what they had seen, but were dismissed and met with outright skepticism. But when the children returned home that evening and they told their parents, the incident was taken with more seriousness. Many of the parents came to the school the next day to discuss what had happened with the faculty, but the staff at the Aero School had no details or information for them. Whilst dismissive of the story, the staff couldn't understand why so many of the children all corroborated the same outlandish and astonishing series of events. The parents were determined to get answers, however, and many went to the press. Some of the children were certain that they had met aliens from another world. Others felt that they had come across beings known in South African culture as Tikoloshes, mischievous dwarf or goblin-like water spirits, creatures of Shona and Ndebele folklore, who liked nothing more than causing trouble for those who came across them. Anyway, as I mentioned, the sighting was reported by parents to ZBC Radio News, and it was from that report that Cynthia Hind learned about it. Hind, an avid and well-respected UFO phenomenon researcher, visited the school just 4 days later on the 20th of September, 1994. She was able to interview all of the children who had been witness to the close encounter. She broke the interviews down into separate groups of between 4 to 6 children, with each of the groups all corroborating the same consistent story. She also asked them to draw pictures of what they had seen. The images of those drawings are available online, and I encourage you to look them up. They are fairly chilling. Prior to Hind showing up at the school, the BBC's correspondent in Zimbabwe, Tim Leach, visited the school on the 19th of September. He also filmed interviews with both the pupils and the staff. Leach stated following the interviews that he filmed, and I quote, "I could handle war zones, but I could not handle this." The following November, word of the encounter had reached the United States. Harvard University professor of psychiatry, Dr. John Mack, was fascinated by the story and immediately flew out to Zimbabwe to speak with witnesses. Now, Mack was extremely well respected in his field. Throughout the 1990s, Mack had investigated UFO sightings, and in particular, he developed an interest in the alien abduction phenomenon. Mack conducted a decade-long psychological study of some 200 men and women who had all reported experiences of alien abduction or close encounters of the third or fourth kind. Such encounters had seen some limited attention from academic figures. Mack, however, remains quite likely the most esteemed academic to have ever studied the subject to this day. That's not to say, however, that John Mack didn't come up against significant resistance towards the legitimacy of his interest and research, of course. In May 1994, Daniel Tosterson, the Dean of Harvard Medical School, had appointed a committee of peers to confidentially review and potentially debunk Mack's work. Tosterson wanted evidence to refute the clinical investigation of the people who had shared their alien encounters with Mack, and also refute the clinical care that Mack had provided. Does this sound familiar? Yeah, it's essentially the premise of the X-Files, sans Scully, so to speak. Tosterson's issue, primarily, but not exclusively, was that Mack had allegedly communicated to his study group that their experience may have actually been real. Fast forward just over a year, and Harvard eventually issued an apology after more than a year of trying to quash and disprove Mack's work. In a statement, Tostison said that, and I quote, "Harvard and the dean had reaffirmed Dr. Mack's academic freedom to study what he wishes to and to share his opinions without impediment." It was a triumph for Mack, although he had never faltered in his focus anyway. It was a victory, though, for what at the time was considered pseudoscience, an affirmation from one of the leading universities in the world that there was credence to the UFO phenomenon. Jamie, back on track now, come on, geez. According to the interviews and research conducted by Hind, Leach and Mack, the evidence, corroborated and factual record was this. 62 children between the ages of 6 and 12 years old had seen at least one UFO. One or more silver objects or craft described in witness statements as discs had appeared in the daytime sky. The objects then slowly floated down and landed in a field of brush and small trees to the north of the school's perimeter. The craft gave off a flute-like high-pitched noise. Between one and four creatures with big black eyes and dressed in black jumpsuits exited the craft and approached the children. At this point, many of the children ran, but some, mostly older pupils, stayed and watched the entity approach them. The creature or creatures then telepathically communicated to the children a series of environmental, war, and planetary concerns before returning to their craft and flying away. It's worth noting that I looked up some data regarding where the planet was at, so to speak, in regards to the message communicated by the entities at the time. Operation Julin by the United States had recently completed 7 nuclear tests in the years leading up to the 1994 incident. The United Kingdom's NTS series had also just completed a 24 nuclear bomb test run, and China was in the midst of a 6-bomb nuclear test program. Further, and some of our old listeners will remember this, at this time there was a 24 million square kilometer hole in our ozone layer, which was causing significant harm to the planet by allowing dangerous levels of ultraviolet light into our atmosphere. And there would still be several years before the Montreal Protocol, which was ratified in 1989, would even begin to address this issue. Finally, between 1990 and 1994, there were 4 significant oil spills in or off the coast of Uzbekistan, Mozambique, Spain, and Puerto Rico, and the Gulf War oil spills as a result of the NATO war with Iraq had left considerable environmental impact, as did the subsequent Kuwaiti oil field fires. From a perspective of war, something that mankind is probably best at, well, in the 10 years leading up to the 1994 encounter, there were 19 conflicts or wars across 6 continents, 5 instances of mass rioting, and none of this included the major offensive by the United States, United Kingdom, and their allies against Iraq, or the 45-year-old Cold War standoff, which was coming to an end. The Earth was in a problematic state, you could say. Maybe the entities had a point. Skeptics, like the aforementioned Brian Dunning, have described the incident as one of mass hysteria, possible shared delusional disorder, or a folie à deux, if you will, or in this case, folie à soixante-deux. Just bear in mind that not all children at the school that day stated that they had saw something, but 62 did, which is a considerable number. Respected UFO phenomenon researcher and writer Jerome Clark subsequently called the incident the most remarkable close encounter of the third kind of the 1990s. Clark, from Minnesota in the United States, has authored more than 14 works on the subject of UFOs and is often the go-to guy for newspapers, magazines, television news, and documentary filmmakers looking for professional and informed information on the subject. The Ariel School UFO incident is possibly the most famous UFO case to come out of Africa. It featured on a June 2021 episode of BBC's Witness History. Ufologists to this day cite the case as providing compelling evidence of extraterrestrial visits to Earth. In December 2020, Brian Dunning devoted an episode of his podcast especially to the incident. His show features numerous unexplained incidents throughout history and attempts to debunk them or provide rational explanation. For the most part, I can respect this approach from an analytical data and evidence standpoint. It's the basis of what we do here. However, I think it's important to not approach any subject from a perspective of how can I disprove this encounter as pure fabrication or incorrect interpretation, and how can I use selective data to reinforce my bias? That, my friends, is entirely misinformation. According to Brian Dunnan, the telepathic message that students allegedly received from the entity was not included in Hind or Leach's reports, only Mack's, although Hind reported it later. Dunning also suggested that Mack was a known environmentalist and had prompted and suggested that the telepathic communication had occurred and what was communicated specifically. I do find this pretty shallow criticism of Mack, given his acumen and also his 40-year highly acclaimed career. It's also a little woolly given the significant amount of scientists, scholars and world-renowned academic intellectuals who were at the time calling for greater care and attention to the environment. Wasn't solely a John Mack phenomenon. Dunning further challenged the often repeated statement that as rural school children in Zimbabwe, the witnesses would not have had exposure to modern media and so would not have been familiar with the concept of UFOs and alien visitors. Dunning felt that they would have been just as aware of UFOs and aliens as Western children were. I think that's a fair assumption. Although, in my trawl through the video footage of interviews with the children recorded by BBC's Tim Leach, recorded just 3 days after the incident, there is one particular clip where one of the children specifically states that she had never heard of aliens or UFOs before the encounter. I'll pop a link in this episode's notes where you can visit a page on our website that contains a number of the drawings the children made for Cynthia Hind during her interviews with them. I'll also include some video links where you can hear the children talk firsthand about their experiences. It's all valuable evidence and certainly worth a look. Many of the children who were involved in the encounter still tell the same corroborating story to this day, at least the ones who are willing to discuss it. A number were left psychologically distraught following the event, and many are afraid to try and recall the events, much less talk about them. Emily Trim, who was 11 at the time of the encounter and one of the closest witnesses to the entity, has recalled the incident over and over in her dreams almost every night since the incident, she says. Now living in Canada and working as a self-employed artist, Emily states that the encounter affected her in a massive way and forever changed her. While she wasn't fearful of the entity at the time, she says, it did communicate fear and urgency with her. It was disappointed at our attitude and apathy toward nature and our surrounding ecology. The entity also did not understand and was confused by our species' want to kill, hate, and wage war. It limited our evolution and progress, the entity felt. Trim, whose art today is influenced by her encounter in 1994, also feels that there was more to the encounter than the children can recall. All the witnesses felt that time slowed down or stopped, and all the witnesses have gaps in recalling certain points in the encounter. Trim believes that the children could possibly have been taken aboard the spacecraft, although she has no evidence to substantiate these claims. She also believes and fears that the creatures will return, and that she can sense when they are back in the Earth's atmosphere. For those interested in checking out Emily Trim's aerial encounter inspired art, you can do so by heading over to her Instagram at Emily_Trim_86. Check it out. Salma Siddick was an 11-year-old in grade 6 at the aerial school in September 1994. She now lives in America's Pacific Northwest. She doesn't mind talking about that day occasionally, she says, but to this very day she cannot explain it, and it causes her to often lose sleep, staying up all night playing the events over and over and over in her head. Cynthia Hind died in the year 2000. She had publicly acknowledged her own experiences with otherworldly beings in the past and had dedicated the last 2 decades of her life to investigating UFO sightings on the African continent. There she represented the Mutual UFO Network and subsequently published her findings in the very sought-after and respected newsletter, UFO Afro News. Dr. John E. Mack had been a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. The prize awarded for his 1977 study of Lawrence of Arabia was titled A Prince of Our Disorder, The Life of T.E. Lawrence. He was also a highly respected professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School. Snippets of Mac's interviews with the children can still be found on YouTube today. A fifth grader called Francis tells the gentle-eyed psychiatrist he was warned about something that's going to happen and that pollution mustn't be. 11-year-old Emma says, "I think they want people to know that we are actually making harm on this world and we mustn't get too technologied." Her pronunciation. Mac was sadly killed in a car accident on the 27th of September 2004. He was hit by a drunk driver on Totteridge Lane in London, where he was in town to give a lecture at the T.E. Lawrence Society. Sadly, he died at the scene. Some of his supporters and family members founded the Johnny Mac Institute, with a mission to, and I quote, "explore the frontiers of human experience, to serve the transformation of individual consciousness, and to further the evolution of the paradigms by which we understand human identity." In the aftermath of John Mack's death, his family reached out to Wood Green Crown Court in London and asked the judge to spare the drunk driver a harsh sentence and show leniency. Back in the 1990s, when I was much younger and less worldly wise, I wrote a letter to Dr. Mack. He replied, and it sits proudly in a frame in my home studio, surrounded by a range of letters I have from infamous serial killers, criminals, hoaxers, and politicians. I asked Dr. Mack how advanced he felt the extraterrestrial visitors to Earth were and where he thought they came from. I also asked if he thought they would ever do us harm. Dr. Mack replied with the following. "We must adjust our understanding and accept changes in our perception of time and space. Witnesses to extraterrestrial encounters and abductees are often affected by a sense of, the existence of, or of moving into, other realities or dimensions. This may be difficult for us who live in the third dimension to understand or articulate, but be sure that beings of such advanced culture and technology are certainly not flying across the universe in rocket-propelled vehicles and undergoing decades-long travel. They may even be from here, just another here to what we can perceive. The entities that visit us, numerous as they may be, would almost certainly not harm us. If anything, at their stage of evolution, they are best placed to study us and learn why we are the way we are."
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.